Hi gang, David Michael Phelps here. Thanks for tuning in to Working Man. Life here at Harmel Academy continues to be quite an adventure. And while more episodes of Working Man are in the works, we thought today we'd share something a little bit different than our normal interview. It isn't always easy for people to understand how a Catholic trade school works, especially when you consider that the trade school combines skills trades training with intellectual and spiritual formation. And frankly, it's not always easy to explain how it works. So today, we're going to attempt to show you instead of tell you, if only in a small way. In today's episode, we'd like to give you a little glimpse of what it sounds like to study the humanities in the context of the skilled trades. We're going to do that by publishing part of a lecture from one of our humanities classes, a class called God and Man at Work. In this lecture, you'll hear a talk that helps make the turn from the first part of the class, where our students were studying the theology of the body, to the second part of the class, where they begin laying a foundation for a theology of work. This lecture is about J.R.R. Tolkien's poem, Mythopoeia. And if you're like our students, you may be wondering how a poem on mythmaking can help lay the groundwork for a spiritual understanding of work in the skilled trades. But as I argue in this talk, and yes, as gauche as it is to introduce one's own lecture, it is me giving this talk. As I argue in this talk, our work is actually a part of a more fundamental way of existing in the world, a way of existing that might be best understood by approaching it from the side. In this case, approaching it by considering what a poet does. So as I say, this is just a little glimpse of how Harmel works, a sample of the discussions we have here, and we hope you enjoy it. So, Mythopoeia by J.R.R. Tolkien. Okay, so the background of this poem, real quick. Tolkien, I'm sure some of you guys are probably familiar with Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit and all this sort of thing. There's lots of fans of this. Tolkien taught at Oxford, and for several years, his best friend was C.S. Lewis, okay, who's also another famous author. But when they met, Lewis was an atheist, and they still hit it off. They were still real good buddies. They had an enjoyment of mythology and poetry and literature, right? So this is sort of animated their friendship. And at one point, they were arguing about the nature of mythology. And Lewis said that mythology were lies breathed through silver. So at the beginning of this poem, it says, "To one who said that myths were lies and therefore worthless, even though breathed through silver," right? He's dedicating this poem to C.S. Lewis. But this is the atheist C.S. Lewis. This is pre-conversion C.S. Lewis. Okay? So I'm going to read through this, and then we'll call out a couple things, and then, so just what this has to do with this, let's just put that on pause for a second, okay? Okay, so he subtitles it Philomythus to Mizomythus. That means the lover of myths to the hater of myths, right? Okay. You look at trees and label them just so, for trees are trees, and growing is to grow. You walk the earth and tread with solemn pace one of the many minor globes of space. A star is a star, some matter in a ball, compelled to courses mathematical amid the regimented, cold, inane, where destined atoms are each moment slain. At bidding of a will, to which we bend and must, but only dimly apprehend, great processes march on as time unrolls from dark beginnings to uncertain goals. And as on page or written without clue, with script and limning packed of various hue, an endless multitude of forms appear, some grim, some frail, some beautiful, some queer, each alien, except as kin from one remote origo, gnat, man, stone, and sun. God made the petrous rocks, the arboreal trees, tellurian earth, and stellar stars, and these homuncular men who walk upon the ground with nerves that tingle, touched by light and sound. The movements of the sea, the wind in the boughs, green grass, the large, slow oddity of cows, thunder and lightning, birds that wheel and cry,
slime crawling up from mud to live and die. These each are duly registered and print the brain's contortion with a separate dint. Yet, trees are not trees until so named and seen. And never were so named till those had been whose speech's involuted breath unfurled faint echo and dim picture of the world, but neither record nor a photograph, being divination, judgment, and a laugh, response of those that felt a stir within by deep monition movements that were kin to life and death of trees, of beasts, of stars. Free captives, undermining shadowy bars, digging the foreknown from experience, and panning the vein of spirit out of sense. Great powers they brought out of themselves, and looking backwards, they beheld the elves that wrought on cunning forges in the mind, and light and dark on secret looms entwined. He sees no stars who does not see them first, of living silver made, that sudden burst to flame like flowers beneath an ancient song, whose very echo after music long has since pursued. There is no firmament, only a void, unless a jeweled tent, myth-woven and elf-patterned, and no earth, unless the mother's womb whence all have birth. The heart of man is not compound of lies, but draws some wisdom from the only wise and still recalls him. Though now long estranged, man is not wholly lost nor wholly changed. Disgraced he may be, yet is not dethroned, and keeps the rags of lordship once he owned, his world dominion by creative act. Not his to worship the great artifact, man, sub-creator, the refracted light through whom is splintered from a single white to many hues and endlessly combined in living shapes that move from mind to mind. Though all the crannies of the world we filled with elves and goblins, though we dared to build gods and their houses out of dark and light and sow the seed of dragons, 'twas our right, used or misused. The right has not decayed. We make still by the law in which we're made. Yes, wish fulfillment dreams we spin to cheat our timid hearts and ugly fact defeat. Whence came the wish? And whence the power to dream? Or some things fair and others ugly deem? All wishes are not idle, nor in vain, nor in vain fulfillment we devise, for pain is pain, not for itself to be desired, but ill, or else to strive or to subdue the will alike were graceless. And of evil, this alone is dreadly certain. Evil is. Blessed are the timid hearts that evil hate, that quail in its shadow and yet shut the gate, that seek no parley, and in guarded room, though small and bare, upon a clumsy loom weave tissues gilded by the far-off day, hoped and believed in undershadow's sway. Blessed are the men of Noah's race that build their little arks, though frail and poorly filled, and steer through winds contrary towards a wraith, a rumor of a harbor guessed by faith. Blessed are the legend makers, with their rhyme of things not found within recorded time. It is not they who have forgot the night, or bid us flee to organized delight, in lotus aisles of economic bliss for swearing souls to gain a Circe kiss, and counterfeit at that, machine-produced, bogus seduction of the twice seduced. Such isles they saw afar, and ones more fair, and those that hear them yet may be, beware. They have seen death and ultimate defeat, and yet they would not despair retreat. But oft to victory have turned the lyre and kindled hearts with legendary fire, illuminating now and dark hath been with light of suns as yet by no man seen. I would that I might with the minstrel sing and stir the unseen with a throbbing string. I would be with the mariners of the deep that cut their slender planks on mountain steep and voyage upon a vague and wandering quest, for some have passed beyond the fabled west. I would with the beleaguered fools be told that keep an inner fastness where their gold impure and scanty, yet they loyally bring to mint an image blurred of distant king. Or in fantastic banners weave the sheen, heraldic emblems of a lord unseen. I will not walk with your progressive apes, erect and sapient. Before them gapes the dark abyss to which their progress tends, if by God's mercy progress ever ends and does not ceaselessly revolve the same unfruitful course with changing of a name. I will not tread your dusty path and flat, denoting this and that by this and that, your world immutable, wherein no part the little maker has with maker's art. I bow not yet before the iron crown, nor cast my own small golden scepter down. In paradise, perchance, the eye may stray from gazing upon everlasting day to see the day illumined, and renew from mirrored truth the likeness of the true. Then looking on the blessed land, 'twill see that all is as it is, and yet made free. Salvation changes not, nor yet destroys, garden nor gardener, children nor their toys. Evil it will not see, for evil lies not in God's picture, but in crooked eyes. Not in the source, but in malicious choice. And not in sound, but in the tuneless voice. In paradise, they look no more awry. And though they make anew, they make no lie. Be sure, they still will make, not being dead, and poets shall have flames upon their head, and harps whereon their faultless fingers fall, there each shall choose forever from the all. Okay, there's a ton going on here. I'm going to pull out a few important notes, and then we will relate it to what we're doing, okay? The first thing Tolkien's doing in this poem is he's making a distinction between two worlds, or you might say two views of the world. The first we might call the world of things, dead, cold things, right? A star is just a matter in a ball, right? Confined to courses mathematical, right? Everything is just dead, raw material, meaningless, without meaning. It doesn't speak of God the way we've been talking about the world speaking of God. And this is what materialists, right, will often call the real world. That's the real world, right? What's really there is just matter, merely matter, just stuff, just energy, that sort of stuff, right? Okay? So that's one view of the world, that the world does not speak of God. The world is meaningless. That all reality is really reduced to just fact, or scientifically observed fact at that. The other view of the world is the world not just of things, but things to know, or things to name. Now, I told you already that this was a response to Lewis the Atheist. So let's just put in our minds here for a second that there's basically two characters here. And one of them is presenting his point of view to the other, right? Philomythos, the lover of myths, to Mizomythos, the hater of myths. And we'll just, for the sake of argument, we'll say, okay, there's Lewis the Atheist, the materialist. And then there's Tolkien, the Christian. Materialism, like I just said, is a view that reality is nothing but material. But if you're a materialist, you've got a problem. You got a bunch of problems, okay? But you've got a sort of intellectual problem. Somehow you need to account for not just things, but phenomena. And what I mean by phenomena, right, is not just the things, but the things as they are perceived or seen or known. So it's one thing, that tree out there, to exist. It's another thing for that tree to be known, to be seen, to experience, to be smelt, to be felt. Okay? And the reason that this is a problem for a materialist is, how do you explain, not the tree, that's easy enough to just think of, oh, it's just dead matter. How do you explain me sensing the tree, knowing the tree? And in other words, how do you explain my consciousness of the tree? And if you're a good Orthodox materialist, you say, well, sooner or later we will discover the neurological, biological, chemical, quantum explanation that explains consciousness. And I'm no neuroscientist, but one thing I do know about neuroscience is that the big fish that no one can seem to crack is consciousness itself. There doesn't seem to be an explanation for why we should even be conscious of things. There certainly is no neurological explanation that we can see, or physical, or chemical, or quantum, right? Yeah, it's just a super complex, you know, there's just a complexity of the brain that we don't understand. And maybe that's right, okay? I don't want to, theoretically, that could be right, but you can see that that is a problem that the materialist worldview has, is because there is something like sublimity, the sublime, the aesthetic, right? The powerful, the power of music or the power of love, right? That's very, very difficult to explain. You can start to reduce it down to things like sexual drives or biological processes, but that doesn't really seem to explain it very well at all, right? So you have this problem as a materialist to not just reckon with like the cosmos, but our experience of the cosmos, our consciousness of the cosmos, our awareness, and in its more sophisticated forms, what we do with that awareness, telling stories, making myths, creating art, writing music. Very, very mysterious, very difficult to explain in materialist terms. This is the ground on which Tolkien sort of makes his attack. What he does in this poem is he gives us an alternate explanation of human experience, and one that sort of situates the fact that we have experiences in a more cohesive explanation of what it means to be human and what the world is. But also, the argument he gives is almost like a self-proof, like it's a proof of the concept itself. All right, so the argument in his poem begins with this question. Okay, listen, if the world is only a thing, why is it that it presents itself as something more than that to us? Right? If it's just dead raw matter amid the regimented cold inane where destined atoms are each moment slain, then why is it that on this world throughout time, as on page or written without clue with script and limning, past the various hue an endless multitude of forms appear? Forms, meaning ideas or concepts or phenomena. Why do these things appear? If dead, raw fact was all there is, then how does it happen that we even get the idea of something more than that, right? If the world was only dead, raw, meaningless fact, where does the dream of meaning come from? This is his question. If the world were just strictly material, how do we even get the idea of the spiritual? Where would that even come from? Like if it didn't exist, if it wasn't really there, where does the illusion come from? So this is where he starts. Now, he says these things, made things, he talks about all of these made things that not are just things, but have qualities to them. He says, The petrous rocks, the arboreal trees. Petrous is a word that means rocky. Arboreal means tree-ish, right? These rocky rocks, the tree-ish trees, the Tellurian earth, right? The earth, right? The stellar stars and these homuncular men, these mannish men, right? That fact alone, You might say the quality of them creates this big question for us. He developed the sort of thing. I mean, is a little hard to understand using the terms he uses here. So I'm just going to jump over real quick. There's an essay in here called "On Fairy Stories." If you haven't read it, it's excellent. Okay, but he makes a similar argument on fairy stories, and I think with that argument, it'll be a little easier to understand the point he's raising here. He points out in this essay this really weird thing about language and about human consciousness. He calls it the invention of the adjective, which sounds like the most ordinary thing. Like, we use adjectives describing words all the time. It's a very everyday thing. But just because it's everyday doesn't mean it's not really weird when you think about it. So he uses the example, among others, of grass. He says, at some point, we saw grass. There it is, I see it. Right? Photons of light bounce off that grass, right? And the sensors in my eye receive those photons. Okay? If this was just pure, you know, physical universe with no metaphysical grounding or whatever, okay, we could just explain it in that term. The thing is, though, is that humans don't perceive that simply as, say, grass, or a particular shape, right? When they see grass, they don't just see grass. They see green grass. If I remember right, he even hyphenates it in his essay, green-grass. Green grass, right? He not only perceives the grass, that physical thing, he also perceives green. And he perceives green in distinction from the grass, which is really weird. Because it's not just the thing that he is perceiving, it's a category, a concept that isn't physical. There's no such thing, so to speak, as green. You can't just show me some green. It's always a green something. You know what I mean? A green grass, a green truck, a green leaf. It's always a thing. But in our minds, we can devise concept, name, language for something that doesn't exist materially, physically. Where would we ever get the idea for that? If all there really was material or physical perception, how do we get this more than material idea? You might say almost like a spiritual material, or the spiritual idea. Tolkien finds in this something we might call like the spiritual senses of humanity. There's like a spiritual sense, not just the physical senses we have, but there's a type of, you might say, spiritual sense the human person has. One way we might define that sort of thing in terms, in the language that we've been using, is that man has the ability to read the spiritual from the physical. Almost we can read the language of spirit in the writing of the material. He puts it in here that we are panning the spirit, panning the vein of spirit out of sense. Like panning gold, right? We take the material and we can pan out of it the spiritual. If we take senses, we sort of shift, we can sort of pan out of the senses the gold of the spiritual. Or, to use the line that Seamus Heaney, he called it gleaning the unsaid off the palpable. So this sort of spiritual literacy, right? We can think of it like a spiritual literacy almost. We can look at the physical, and we seem to be able to deduce out of it or read out of it something that's more than physical. Now, this ability to read that language, I'm going to use a name for it, a Greek word, poiesis. The word poem comes from this word, but it just means making. Okay? So what I want to do here is I want to talk about making, not simply as assembling stuff, but as a way of speaking a certain language. Man sort of can speak the spiritual language within the material world. And he can almost read it off the material world and speak it into the world. But he can almost, in a sense, speak it not simply in his language. He can speak this spiritual language, so to speak, not just in his language, or you might say just the verbal language, the language of his words, but he can speak the language physically. Not just with his body, like we talked about earlier, as spouse, father, etc., but also in arranging the syntax or the grammar of physical things. So when I build something, you can think of that. I want you to start thinking of that as a type of speech. So language, we tend to think about as this thing that's verbal or conceptual, and it is, right? And it has nouns and verbs and actions and adjectives, all these sorts of things, right? But what I would like us to do for the sake of discussion and argument over the next few weeks is start talking about this idea that when we make something, we're speaking a language too. And I don't mean this purely as a metaphor. What I mean is we're arranging things in the world in the way that we might arrange words in a sentence. But if the world speaks, if the physical world speaks, has meaning, then we arrange that meaning. It's kind of like writing in a way. You know what I mean? There is, you might say, to that machine back there, a very particular grammar, vocabulary, syntax, dialect in that machine. And I don't mean this purely as a metaphor. I mean, there's a way that that machine works and is what it is to do what it does. We could change it. We could modify it. We could augment it. We could simplify it, right? We could, quote unquote, edit it to do something else. But what it is doing is not simply a raw, dead function. In a way, it's saying something. It's communicating something. One of the things that machine there, a lathe, we'll just speak of lathe generally, one of the things that it communicates is the mathematical ordering of space, right? So think about a lathe, right? There's sort of three axes, X, Y, Z axes. If I were to just put let's use wood as an example, okay? Have you guys ever seen wood turned on a lathe? I'm assuming everyone's seen wood turned on a lathe before, right? Now, very often you'll just use a pre-processed piece of lumber or something like that. But imagine if you just had a hunk of a chunk of wood, right? That was not is not square or anything like that. It's just a gnarled hunk of wood or whatever, right? Okay? You move from sort of this gnarled hunk of wood. Imagine you're turning it down into a simple cylinder. Well, what is the machine communicating? It's communicating something like order or balance or the evenness of two axes or three axes. Like in its most basic form, a lathe to that piece of wood is the lathe is built to do or to communicate a certain thing, and it communicates it to that hunk of matter. And now that hunk of matter, that wood, is a cylinder. It has, you know, a balance to it. It has a smoothness to it, a direction, a sense of line, okay? There's a sense that when man can not only read the language, he can see the green and grass, or he can see the use or potential in the world or make something out of it. There's a sense in which he not only speaks the language of creation, but in speaking the language of creation, furthers and continues creation. Tolkien calls him a sub-creator. Now he's talking more specifically about the creation, like verbal creation, stories and myths, right? But I think it applies equally to any type of creativity. Any type of creativity. Man, in speaking, creation is furthering creation. Now, the alternative view, like we said before, of atheist Lewis atheism, of the raw dead fact of the desacralized, demythologized world, the ashy heap of meaningless of the world, we'll call it, right? The alternative is that the world is nothing but a machine, right? Nothing but sort of mechanical, predetermined actions. And in that world, man himself is just another cog in the machine, right? He is just predestined. Everything, if you were a good enough measurer and mathematician, you would be able to calculate all of history, all of cosmic history, if you just had all the right measurements from the Big Bang, right? If it was all just a mathematical process, right? If you were really good at math, had enough time, good enough measurement, you could just calculate it. But what that means is if the whole world is just this machine, so to speak, then so is man. But if that's the case, that still doesn't get rid of Tolkien's main point, which is just weird. It's just weird that in the entire cosmic machinery, if all it is dead machinery, it's just really weird that one part of it has sort of like dreaming and speaking and loving and singing and storytelling and making and creativity. Like, it's really weird, right? I mean, you'd expect to see it all over, at least some other place, and maybe it is some other place, maybe we just don't know. But it just doesn't seem to fit. All right. Here's the sort of thing I mean. Imagine like this. Imagine if the world simply was just a mechanical process playing itself out. A mechanical, mathematical process. Wouldn't it be weird? I mean, think of it like an assembly line for automobiles. Wouldn't it be weird if in an assembly line for automobiles, part of the assembly line, right, installs the radio in the dash of the car or something like that. It would be like saying, and you turn the radio on, oh, wow, the assembly line created music. Whoa, holy cow. What an assembly line. What a machine. It'd be kind of weird, right? Yeah. I mean, to think that just because the assembly line assembled the radio, that somehow it also created the music in the radio? I mean, that would be ridiculous. No. It must be coming from somewhere else. The music must be coming from somewhere else, you would think. In the same way, it'd be really, really weird if that the human capacity to love, to dream, to think, to create, to read the spiritual, to glean the unsaid off the palpable, if that skill, if we thought that was just a mechanistic process, just resulted from a machinery. It's the same sort of odd as it would be to assume that the assembly line created music just because it installed the radio in the dash. But if you're a materialist, that's the sort of thing you'd have to end up defending. And that somehow in creating the radio, the assembly line was also creating the music. Okay? Now, there are more complicated, sophisticated ways that materialists will sort of make a case like this. I don't want to oversimplify or commit the straw man fallacy, which is to say I'm just creating a simple version of a materialist argument. There are better ones, but really not that much better in my opinion. The point is what we're trying to do is establish a language here about man who is speaking and reading the world, and by speaking it is helped to bring it into being. And when this point is made, we can begin to understand what we need to in order to discover or rediscover, you might say, the dignity of creating, of making, and of working. There's a sense in which, all, like I said earlier, all making is it's a type of speaking. It's a type of language. In a way, I don't want to push this too far, but I think I literally mean it when I say making and working is all a type of poetry, poesis. We can speak in the language of metal. We can speak that language. We can learn to speak that language. And I think it's even helpful because Tolkien sort of, I think, rightly despised what the Industrial Age did in some ways. But that doesn't mean there isn't a... So it can be easy to sort of like anything that has to do with machines, right, can be seen as not really true or, you know, genuine or whatever. I think that's an error. I think there is such a thing as the right understanding of, you might say, the spirituality of machines, for lack of a better word. It's there. But the age and the Industrial Age really was the same age where we started forgetting that the world speaks. So there really isn't a great vocabulary for what we call the machinery of, I'm sorry, the spirituality of machines. There's not a good vocabulary for that. Maybe you guys can help develop one, because I think there is one that's there. But it begins with this understanding that all making is a type of language. It's a type of making. It's a type of poetry, rather. Here's another way of seeing what I mean when we say when we can read the world and speak it, not just verbally, but in our actions and with our work, right? We can speak that language in the form of construction or metal or whatever it is. Another way of saying that is that when we are helping create the world in that way is to say we're augmenting the world. We're augmenting the world. And this word augment is very interesting because we'll play a little more of the etymology game here real quick. Augment is a Latinate word, right? Comes from augeo. Augera is the infinitive form. It means to increase. It means to enlarge. It means to magnify. It means to exalt. It means to honor, to promote, to advance. It also means to stoke up a fire. It means to raise your voice. Right? This is what the word augura means. There's another Latin word that comes from this. The one who augments, the one who increases, the one who magnifies, the one who originates, the person that does this, is called the auctor. This is the word we get our English word author from. To author something means to originate it, to be the point of its creation, to be the point of its magnification or augmentation or magnification or exaltation or promotion, to be the one who's fanning the fire, right, so to speak. So we talk about this idea that even, right, what was it again? Say it again.
What did I say?
And even if there is no meaning?
Oh, even if there is no lining meaning, there will remain a word wakened by lips that perish.
A word wakened by lips that perish, right? That fire, that, right, the boy in the word, in the road, right? That fire that is carrying, being fanned into flame, that is authorship, that is making, that is augmenting, that is enlarging, that is magnifying, that is exalting, that is praising. So we're going to turn to this idea, right, of man as author of increase. In a way, that's kind of a redundant phrase, because literally means the increaser of increase. But there's a sense in which that not only in our sort of bodies are we procreative. Not only in our bodies are we procreative, right? But in our acting in the world, right? We are procreative as, you might say, spouses and fathers. But we're also procreative as authors, makers, or we might say poets of creation. You may not write poetry in words. None of you may write poetry in words. But all of you, by being makers, all of you, by being workers, And later we'll talk specifically about maintainers of things that are made. That's a whole subset of making. Because the error we don't want to fall into is only the inventors, only the people that build something completely new are somehow doing this. No. Maintainers, fixers, are also augmentors. And we'll talk about this whole idea of the maintainer as being an often overlooked subset of making. But even though you don't write poetry in, say, words or language, all of you are poets, all of you are makers, but the words you use are things. You're speaking a sort of material poetry. That machine back there is a highly sophisticated piece of poetry, of making, a highly sophisticated made thing of matter that communicates, that does, that means. But the point is that machine is a poem in steel. And so even if you don't write poetry in words, you write it in other things. You write it in metal. You write it in wood. You write it in the material of the world. And that's how I really want you to not only... I guess I should say this before we're done. I don't say this to romanticize what it is you're doing. Do you understand what I mean? What we shouldn't do is say, oh, well, this is a way of somehow finding the dignity by comparing it to, you know, art or something like that, you know, because art is a higher thing. No, that's not what I'm saying at all. If anything, I'm saying the reverse. If anything, I'm saying that there is this, almost this type of fuller making, poesis, poem, because it's something that is spirit and matter together, form and material together, that we're able to speak that language, that incarnate sort of language. When we are procreative, when we procreate, we are furthering creation. And like I said, we do that with our bodies biologically, spiritually, as spouses and parents. But we're also procreative as authors, makers, poets of creation, builders, doers, workers. Now, this is a different type of procreation, right? I don't have to save up for the college fund of, you know, that machine. And clearly, that machine is not a person. But the point is that in both ways, we are furthering creation. We are not just, you know, earning a paycheck or putting up with work so that we can do the things we really want to do or the things that really matter. Or worse, as some people would have it, well, you put up with all the work and the toil so you, you know, you have some money and some of it you can give to the church. Well, yeah, you give money to the church, but like contributing to God's designs in the world is way more than that. We are making. And as to use the language of before, we are making something specific. We are making a home.
Thanks again for listening to Working Man. As I mentioned at the top of the episode, we're hard at work keeping this new school moving forward. And in fact, we're mere weeks away from graduating our first class, thanks be to God. Launching a school in the opening months of a global pandemic was, to say the least, daunting. But thanks be to God that we have come this far. Hey, if you know anyone who might be interested in our work, the work of forming working men in the skilled trades, both in their hands and in their hearts and their heads, if they're students or donors or partners or priests, if you know anyone who'd be interested in the work of Harmel, would you please send them our way? You can find us on most of the socials or at harmelacademy.org. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.